resolution would be interpreted as an end to the joint understanding between Iran and the IAEA reached more than a week ago, allowing the agency to continue with necessary verification work in the country. Gharibabadi said the E3 exercised a prudent approach by considering the consequences of their proposal.
We welcome such an approach by the Board of Governors and also the E3 countries, and it shows that the wisdom prevails, actually. And in my view, by stopping the process of pursuing this resolution, an unnecessary tension was prevented.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said Tehran had accepted his initiative to engage in a focused, systematic effort to clarify a number of outstanding issues.
We were able to have an understanding, and we are going to be starting this process of focused analysis of the situation with a technical meeting, which will take place in Iran the beginning of April, which I hope will be followed by other technical or political meetings as agreed by both sides.
Grossi said his intention is to come to a satisfactory outcome in time for the next regular session of the board next June. The agency says it wants to clarify questions concerning the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has already provided the agency with complementary access to three locations. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says Tehran is also determined to resolve the remaining issues, although it does not believe in setting artificial deadlines. Homolezki, Vienna.
Preliminary data released by the National Bureau of Statistics ISTAT shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020. Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and healthcare.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded across all European countries and in the UK after the 2008 financial crisis. Italy has struggled to pick up from that downturn due to a fragmentation of anti-poverty policies and ineffective employment strategies.
Statistical body ISTAT also stressed that the monthly spending of the average Italian household dropped by almost 10%. Sent to about 2,300 euros last year, the lowest value since 2000.
Those without solid job contracts are the most exposed in the COVID-19 crisis that has already killed almost 100,000 people in Italy, the second highest death toll in Europe. Food security is emerging as a key issue for an increasing number of Italians.
The cost of living has risen to unbearable levels. My son used to work as a temporary employee in a restaurant. He has been jobless for months now. How long can we carry on this way?
The previous government hasn't helped Italy much. My daughter has been temporarily laid off, and her pay is now one-third of what it used to be.
Discontent among Italians is also growing over a much delayed vaccination campaign. So far, 1.5 million people, about 3% of the population only, have been inoculated with both COVID vaccine doses amid delays and disputes in the delivery schedule across the whole of the European Union. Max Civili, Rome.
Presidents of 17 universities from 10 member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization attended the online session to exchange views and ways to expand scientific cooperation. Hosted by Iran's Allama Tabatabai University, the event was attended by university heads from Pakistan, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan.
I would like to express my gratitude for the invitation to such an important event. At the Kyrgyz-Russian Slavic University, there are 9,000 students, 7 faculties, and 92 departments. Out of this number, Over 1,600 are international students coming from 19 countries, including from ECHO member states.
We have a lot of potential. We have a lot of opportunities to collaborate with each other. How we can collaborate? There is a faculty exchange program. We can collaborate in terms of faculty exchange, in terms of student exchange.
Allama Tabatabai University, which hosted the session, was founded in 1984 with two departments of literature and humanities and administrative and commercial sciences. The ATU then expanded its academic activities by launching more departments, such as Persian literature and foreign languages, social sciences, economics, accounting and management, psychology and educational sciences, and health and basic sciences. Its incumbent president, Hossein Salimi, says the ATU has enormous potential for cooperation with other ECO member states.
We will start with exchanging professors and students and cooperation in research projects and common educational and major project, and I think that we can start with some workshops and some seminars between universities.
Launched in 1985 by Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey with the purpose of promoting economic and technical cooperation, the ECO is an intergovernmental organization which encompasses countries from Europe and Asia, covering a population of 460 million people. The overall objective of the organization is to promote sustainable economic development of its member states and the region. Currently, the regional organization has 10 member states, including Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Azerbaijan.
The ECO was established as a network that connects the economies of the member states. However, delegates here say it can act as more than just an economic link, but as a platform for scientific and technological exchanges. They say today's session was a promising start to that end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
COVID-19 has compounded a problem that was already prevalent in the 27-nation European Union. Poverty affects a quarter of the bloc's citizens in one form or another. The so-called European Pillar of Social Rights Action Plan has just been presented.
Our first aim is to combat child poverty. Too many children in Europe are exposed to the risk of poverty.
A key element of the European Commission's plan is to modernise the EU's education systems. The aim is to lift 15 million people in the EU out of poverty by 2030. Similar targets were missed in the past.
I think the European Commission has been putting forward some interesting proposal to reduce unemployment, but I don't think it goes far enough. I think more needs to be done really to put job creation at the heart of the policy process.
The coronavirus has led to a surge in mental health issues in the EU due to lockdowns and rising unemployment. But unions say the psychological impact is also hitting those still in work. Calls are being made on the European Commission to develop a strategy to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder that could affect many of the bloc's 14.7 million frontline health workers, particularly those who have been administering care in the coronavirus hotspots. Experts say the EU's slow vaccination rollout is allowing mutations of the virus to spread. The European Commission has been asked to respond.
These new variants, where we definitely need to adapt, adjust, prepare, and front-load many of the efforts we have planned.
At this point, it's impossible to say precisely how many people in the EU have been vaccinated.
I have called on member states to increase information on sharing on national vaccination rollout plans and share this data.
The European Commission has announced it will present plans focusing on the easing of COVID-19 restrictions on the 17th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Jubilations among ranks and files of the opposition parties after the Senate elections in Pakistan. The combined opposition parties have managed to retain its majority in 100-member Senate. The Senate elections were held against 37 seats and the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan won 25 seats. Khan's party emerged as the single largest political force in the Senate for the first time. Nonetheless, Khan's party, together with its allies, is still short of 6 senators to gain majority in the Senate. Under the proportionate election systems, 4 provincial parliaments, together with the national parliament, elect 100-member Senate. After every 3 years, half of the senators retire, and regional and federal parliaments elect remaining members of the upper house of the parliament through secret balloting. Despite emerging as the single largest political force in the Senate elections, Khan's party suffered a major setback when the 342-member lower house of the parliament elected opposition candidate Yousaf Rza Gilani as the senator. Gilani is also the former prime minister of Pakistan. With the election of Gilani, the opposition is now eyeing at dislodging the prime minister. The opposition says Khan has lost majority in the National Assembly, which had elected him prime minister in 2018.
Imran Khan ko istifa dena chahiye.
Now Prime Minister Imran Khan must resign. It is not only a demand by the opposition, but Senate pattern indicates that it is also demand of members of the ruling party.
Aapka kya raha?
Opposition candidate won the elections amid a video scandal on mainstream media showing agent of opposition offering tens of millions of dollars to win over MPs of the ruling party.
Inko sharam aani chahiye.
Opposition must feel ashamed of what they are talking about. The video shows selling votes to the opposition, which back up our stance against corruption.
Under pressure from the opposition parties, the government has announced that Prime Minister Imran Khan would soon take a fresh vote of confidence from the National Assembly. Analysts say that Khan is likely to retain his majority in the lower house of the parliament. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to bring former President Abdul Rabbu Mansur Hadi, who had resigned and fled the country, back to power. But with nearly 6 years into the war, Saudi Arabia has achieved none of its goals, and the war has left no choice for Yemenis but to resist. In the latest development, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia's Jeddah on Thursday. The army also said it had successfully hit the King Khalid Airbase in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The attacks come in reaction to Saudi Arabia's ongoing war, despite Washington's pledge to end it. U.S. President Joe Biden ordered to halt arms sales to the kingdom to stop them being used in Yemen. However, Biden pledged to continue supporting Riyadh to defend its sovereignty. Analysts say the U.S. continues to transfer arms to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of selling defensive weapons.
When Joe Biden stated that he was not going to sell offensive missiles and weaponry to Saudi Arabia, that is what we call gobbledygook, because a weapon can be both defensive and offensive.
Besides, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Yemen says the humanitarian situation resulted from the Saudi blockade has even become worse after Biden took office.
Actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration.
The UN had appealed for $3.85 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs in Yemen, but only $1.7 billion was offered at this year's donor conference. The UN described the pledges as disappointing and stressed that cutting aid would mean a death sentence for Yemeni people. Yemen relies on imports that have been badly disrupted over the years by the Saudi-led war and blockade. According to the World Body, the war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. A recent report showed some 16 million Yemenis, or more than half the population, is going hungry. Of those, 5 million are on the brink of famine. The UN stressed that the only solution to end the crisis in Yemen is ceasefire and a political solution. But considering the current stance by the West toward Yemen, it seems the US and its allies do not want the war to stop anytime soon.
In a press conference held in Yemeni capital of Sana'a, the country's Ministry of Water and Environment elaborated on the damage inflicted to the water resources and infrastructure due to the Saudi-led invasion since 2015. The ministry said the war has impacted the sector severely, depriving thousands of Yemenis of access to drinking water. Officials said the war and siege imposed on the country have heavily affected the water supplies and forced millions to use unhealthy ways to store water. However, they say the severe fuel crisis has a major role in water shortage.
The per capita daily share of water consumption has dropped to 35 liters, and the lack of fuel will cause further decline and make matters worse. Water treatment and sanitation are also directly linked to fuel, so lack of fuel and the interruption in these processes may cause epidemics and endanger millions of lives.
Water resources and infrastructure are among the vital sectors that have been targeted by the Saudi-imposed war on Yemen. The war has left millions of Yemeni people without access to food and water, causing what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of Yemenis, including women and children, died of cholera during the 6 years of war. However, the Yemeni struggle to reach clean drinking water continues. The coronavirus pandemic has also worsened the situation in a country where more than 80% of people are in need of humanitarian assistance and support. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gad Za'ev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just they block it either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway or bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expansive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions, and Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation in the coronavirus pandemic. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions by other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julie Bossman and Lucy Tompkins. The piece is titled, Texas Drops Its Virus Restrictions as a Wave of Reopenings Takes Hold. Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expansive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions, as Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions in other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. It is now time to open Texas 100%, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, adding that COVID has not suddenly disappeared, but state mandates are no longer needed. All around the country, governors and mayors are celebrating what is feasible, what is safe, and what is politically practical. In Chicago, Illinois, tens of thousands of children returned to public school this week, while snow-covered parks and playgrounds around the city that have been shuttered since last March were opened up again. Mississippi ended its mask mandate too. Restaurants in Massachusetts were allowed to operate without capacity limits, and South Carolina erased its limit on large gatherings. San Francisco, California announced that indoor dining, museums, movie theaters, and gymnasiums could reopen on a limited basis. But federal health officials have worried that state and local leaders may be moving too fast. I know people are tired. They want to get back to life, to normal, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, said on Monday. But we're not there yet. The divergent guidance has left many Americans in a quandary, wondering whether to follow the lure of optimism as some officials in California, Michigan, and North Carolina endorse widespread reopenings of businesses and schools, or to heed their own lingering concerns about the coronavirus and the warnings of federal health officials who have said it is premature to lift too many limits. As Kitty Sherry, a 36-year-old, sent her son Jude off to his Chicago elementary school this week for the first time in nearly a year, she felt caught in a middle ground between elation and worry. There's a part of me that's really excited that he's back in school, Kitty Sherry said. But she said she worried about the health risk to teachers and said her family was still avoiding restaurants and other indoor spaces because of the coronavirus pandemic. It's not over yet, she said, so there's not too much celebration. Government officials have sent mixed signals, often cautious messages, to the public. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor for COVID-19, said this week that for small groups of people who have all been fully vaccinated, there was low risk in gathering together at home. Activities beyond that, he said, would depend on data, modeling, and good clinical common sense, adding that the Center for Disease Control, CDC, would soon have guidance for what vaccinated people could do safely. The message that many Americans are hearing from their elected officials, including leaders from both political parties, is upbeat. Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan said on Tuesday that she was easing restrictions on businesses and allowing family members who have tested negative for the coronavirus to visit nursing home residents. Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts said that while residents should continue to wear face masks in public, it was time for more limits on businesses to be eased. In Kentucky, all but a handful of school districts are now offering in-person classes, while the state races to vaccinate teachers as quickly as possible. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear told reporters last week that the state's falling infection statistics showed that immunizations were beginning to make an impact. "It means vaccinations work," he said. "We're already seeing it. We're seeing it in these numbers. It's really a positive sign." In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott's lifting of limits goes into effect on 10th of March. Some Democrats sharply criticized the idea, saying it suggests a more optimistic picture of the state's progress with the coronavirus than the reality. There are reasons for optimism. Vaccinations have increased significantly in recent weeks, and daily reports of new coronavirus cases have fallen across the country from their January peaks. The positive signs come with caveats, though. Though national statistics have improved drastically since January, they have plateaued in the last week or so, and the United States is still reporting more than 65,000 new cases a day on average, comparable to the peak of last summer's surge, according to a New York Times database. The country is averaging more than 2,000 deaths per day, though deaths are a lagging indicator because it can take weeks after being infected with the coronavirus to die from it. Also, new, more contagious variants of the coronavirus are circulating in the United States, with the potential to push case counts upwards again. Testing has fallen 30% in recent weeks, leaving experts worried about how quickly new outbreaks will be known. And millions of Americans are still waiting to be vaccinated, including workers in restaurants, which are now open in vast numbers across the country. In states like Florida or South Dakota, schools and businesses have been widely open for months, and many local and state officials across the country have been easing limitations since last summer. Still, the pace of reopenings has quickened considerably in the last few days. "We're hopefully in between what I hope will be the last big wave and the beginning of the period where I hope COVID-19 will become very uncommon," said Robert Horsberg, an epidemiologist at Boston University's School of Public Health. Horsberg added, "But we don't know that. I've been advocating for us to just hang tight for 4 to 6 more weeks." Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said there are signs that the country may be through the worst of the pandemic, but she's still worried that states are reopening too hastily, repeating the same mistakes made in earlier periods of the coronavirus pandemic when loosened rules were followed by new spikes in cases. "Rather than opening a new lower risk things and seeing just to make sure it doesn't change the numbers, it just feels like they're just kind of opening the floodgates," Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo emphasized. Thank you.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back, everyone. Plenty to come in the next half hour, starting with Iran's ambassador to the international organizations in Vienna warning of efforts to abuse the International Atomic Energy Organization as a bargaining chip, saying such moves would undermine the existing goodwill between Iran and the IAEA. Kazem Gharibabadi said any politically motivated move is also immensely counterproductive with regard to the already existing goodwill and mutual trust between the agency and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The remarks come after the IAEA Board of Governors dropped its decision to adopt an anti-Iran resolution over Iran's reduction of its nuclear commitments under Iran's landmark nuclear agreement with world powers in response to the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal, known formally as the JCPOA. The U.S.-backed draft resolution that voiced, quote, serious concern about Iran's reduced cooperation with the IAEA was scrapped in a bid to make room for diplomacy. Meanwhile, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says he believes there's still a window of opportunity for saving the multilateral accord, expressing hope that all sides will return to full compliance. Let's cross over to Vienna, where Homa Lesgi is, to get some more thoughts on that. And Homa, what do you think the U.S. was trying to achieve with this attempt at resolution?
Well, this week, when the IAEA Board of Governors session began, the three European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, that are the remaining Western signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran, they drafted this resolution, and it was reported that they had the backing of the United States, and they had circulated that resolution, and in it there was criticism against Iran, the level of Iran's cooperation with the agency, the issue of safeguards-related issues that the agency has been raising for some time now in its report concerning Iran's cooperation and the questions that the agency has, and of course the result of the law that was passed by the parliament restricting IAEA access, the suspension of the additional protocol. These are all the issues that were raised in that resolution. Now, what happened is that we saw on the first day of the IAEA board meeting, Director General Rafael Grossi in his press conference, without directly and in many words referring to that resolution, he did say, however, that he doesn't want the IAEA to be used as a bargaining chip. These were the words of Mr. Grossi himself in political talk. So he was saying that what's important for the agency is for the inspectors to be able to work in Iran and to be able to have the access that they had before. And he doesn't want the IAEA to get involved in what could be described as political games. This was how a lot of the media were seeing this. This was how Iran was seeing this. And, of course, we saw yesterday that effort to bring to go ahead with this resolution was finally dropped. That resolution did not go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And, Koma, it is known to all that it was the United States that unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA. The question, I guess, is why is there not enough pressure or any pressure at all exerted on them to reinstate themselves into the accord?
This is exactly what was said by the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA in his latest address to the board when he was speaking about Iran's positions concerning the JCPOA. He did say that it was not Iran who left the negotiating table, referring to the joint commission sessions that are held regularly to review the JCPOA. It was the United States, he said, that withdrew, and now it's the responsibility of the United States administration to come back. If they want to come back and around the table, if they want to come back to the Joint Commission, something that was proposed earlier, then they have to take measures to show that they are willing to engage and to return to their commitments. So as far as Iran is concerned, and has been reiterated by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, we know that as far as Iran is concerned, they're not going to return to full compliance before the sanctions are lifted. So what they're saying is it's the responsibility of the U.S. to lift the sanctions. The maximum pressure policy, Iran says, has not worked, And what we're seeing from the Biden administration, they say, is in words, they want to be back in the JCPOA, but in action, not anything yet.
In action and not anything else. Moleski in Vienna, of course. Well, thank you. To Iraq now. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi welcomed Pope Francis to Baghdad earlier today in the first ever visit of the Pope to the country. Despite COVID-19 and security fears, the 84-year-old head of the Catholic Church stated that he was, quote, duty-bound, adding that he hopes to encourage the country's Christian minority population. During his four-day trip, Pope Francis is expected to call for peace in meetings between the country's religious and political leaders, which has seen increased sectarian tensions since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently spoke to the unelected Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido and reiterated Washington's support for regime change. This followed comments from a White House official who told reporters that the Biden administration was in no rush to lift sanctions against Venezuela, instead calling on the Maduro government to take unspecified confidence-building measures. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. Treasury Department levied successive rounds of sanctions against several sectors of the Venezuelan economy, particularly oil. Despite criticism from multilateral bodies, Secretary Blinken said the Biden White House would continue the policy and look to make sanctions more effective. And about that story, Ahmed Caballo spoke to former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, who visited Venezuela in 2017. And he asked him about Washington's unilateral coercive measures against Caracas.
The economic war, combined with the dramatic drop in the oil crisis in 2013-2014, led, of course, to an economic crisis. But an economic crisis that could have been very easily overcome. Why? Because Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, has the second largest gold reserves in the world, has huge bauxite and coltan and lithium and other extremely valuable minerals that they could sell to the world. But if you make it impossible for Venezuela to buy and sell like anybody else, and if you put huge penalties on banks that transfer the money from Venezuela, if Venezuela wants to buy medicine and has to pay for it, well, then you actually asphyxiate the economy. And that is what, starting with Obama, and of course, especially in the 4 years of Trump, that was the policy of maximum pressure. The idea was to cause such chaos in the country that the people would rise up and condemn Maduro, hold him accountable, and overthrow him. The government told you get then regime change. But when I was in Venezuela on the ground, and as I said, I spoke with the opposition, I spoke with the National Assembly, I spoke with the Chamber of Commerce, the Telecamera, I spoke with many opposition NGOs, ProRea, and Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International, etc., who were all very critical of the government. And I also spoke with the people. I also walked the streets. I went into supermarkets to see what the situation was. And since Spanish is my mother tongue, I mean, I could very easily mix. I go around wearing a bow tie. I walked normally with a guayabera, what they usually wear there. And it was clear to me that the common people blamed not Maduro for the lack of medicine, lack of food, et cetera, et cetera. They blamed the United States.
Ahmed also asked Zayas if he felt that there was any attempt to influence his report following his 2017 investigation in Venezuela.
What was expected of me quite clearly was that I would say there is a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. the humanitarian crisis is exclusively the responsibility of the government. The government is not guaranteeing the economic and social rights of the population. So we should have a humanitarian intervention led by the United States in order to obtain regime change. That is more or less what was expected of me. And I can back that up, because no sooner was it public that I was going to go to Venezuela than I started getting letters, and I have them, from non-governmental organizations ostensibly committed to human rights, asking me not to go, telling me that I was not the pertinent rapporteur. And when it was clear that I would go, they were trying to dictate what should be in my report.
The European Union has scrapped plans for a vote on the post-Brexit trade deal agreement after Brussels accused the UK of violating sections of the signed deal. Earlier this week, Boris Johnson's government announced it would unilaterally be changing parts of the agreement to better suit UK businesses in Northern Ireland. The EU has called the move a violation of the UK's agreement with the bloc, adding Brussels would hold off on voting and not set a date for another vote. The current UK-EU trade deal has provisionally been in force for 2 months, but requires a vote in the European Parliament to become permanent. A shipment of more than 250,000 AstraZeneca vaccines destined to Australia has been blocked from leaving the European Union. Big pharma companies are being pressured to honor their contracts as frustration grows across the bloc, with the vaccine rollout going very slowly and with supplies dwindling. Here is more.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia. But nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies and additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia says sanctions imposed on Moscow by the European Union over the situation in Ukraine will be met with a proportionate answer. The EU has extended for another 6 months the sanctions imposed on Russian individuals and organizations accused of undermining the independence of Ukraine. The news comes just a week after the EU announced another series of punitive measures on Russia over the alleged poisoning of convicted far-right Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. More than a dozen human rights groups have urged the U.S. to restrict arms sales to Bahrain and address the ongoing, quote, severe deterioration of human rights within the Persian Gulf Kingdom. In a letter sent to the U.S. government, 15 groups urged Washington to pressure Manama over its ban on opposition political parties and free media. They also pleaded for an end to the Al-Khalifa regime's use of torture and other ill treatment. The letter was signed by UK-based Amnesty International, the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, and a number of other organizations. It comes only a month after the 10-year anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising in Bahrain that was met with a brutal crackdown and killing of pro-democracy protesters. The British royal family has been accused of double standards over its investigation into bullying claims against the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. The co-author of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's biography, Finding Freedom, has questioned why the palace had ordered an investigation into the Duchess, but had not done so with Prince Andrew, who was friends with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and had himself been accused of sexual assault. Others are questioning the timing of the bullying allegations, as they were only revealed after news broke of a controversial interview where Meghan Markle criticized the royal family and referred to them as the firm.
I don't know how they could expect that after all of this time, we would still just be silent if there is an active role that the firm is playing in perpetuating falsehoods about us.
The interview involving the royal couple and American TV personality Oprah Winfrey will air on Sunday.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
It's that time of the broadcast. As we've been reporting, the International Criminal Court has announced an investigation into alleged war crimes committed by Israelis in Palestinian territories. Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has promised the inquiry would be conducted independently, impartially, and objectively, without fear or favor. We already know the Israeli position on it, but what does the American government think of it all? Let's put that question to Richard Sudan. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. A very interesting introduction. I think, first of all, what we should say is quite interesting, the response on a number of levels. Of course, the Palestinians have welcomed the probe and Israel is opposed to it. And just a quick point here on the media. I've been looking at a lot of different media reports, and there's this kind of language of both sides to kind of give an air of neutrality. But I think what's interesting is, what about the facts? Because the facts is the Palestinians have an absolute right to resist the occupation of their country, and this is enshrined under international law. And of course, Israel has one of the most sophisticated armed forces in the world, possibly in history, bolstered to the tune of millions, or billions rather, by the United States. So a lot of people are saying, by what stretch can this even be considered a war, or two equal sides? Now, just on the note of the United States, I think what's also kind of caught a lot of people's attention is the fact that Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and their so-called liberal administration have also said that they're opposed to the probe and have reaffirmed their support for Israel. Now, this has really come under a lot of criticism on social media, but what's also interesting is there's a massive wave of support for the Palestinians. People are welcoming the probe, and they really want the facts regarding, you know, what many people would say as Israel's brutal apartheid occupation and war crimes against the Palestinians to really come to light. So in that sense, maybe it's not surprising that Israel and her biggest ally is actually opposing this probe, Saeed.
I think one point that has to be raised is that the Israelis are saying that this whole thing doesn't fall into the jurisdiction of the ICC, whereas the ICC seems to disagree.
Well, not just the ICC. Most serious countries, most serious political analysts, most serious human rights observers around the world actually say, yes, it does fall into that category. I think Israel have described this probe along the lines of something like legal persecution of its soldiers, which frankly most sort of serious analysts on this issue really find absurd, Saeed. So let's wait and see what happens. But I think, you know, regarding this probe, most people that keep a firm eye on the issue are already aware of the massive sort of alleged war crimes against Palestinians, which have been going on for a lot longer than, of course, 2014.
All right, let's have a look at some of the online reaction to this latest announcement.
And there's many of them. Let's go first to one from News Updates, who says Kamala Harris tells Netanyahu that the USA opposes the ICC probe for possible war crimes of Palestine territories. James Johnson says injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Biden has disgraced America by objecting to a criminal probe of Israel by the ICC. And we have a powerful reaction from Rohan here, who says, if you think an ICC investigation on Palestine is divisive or polarizing, just wait till you hear about the impact of settlements, shooting unarmed protesters, health workers destroying hospitals, killing 556 children in 51 days, and the indiscriminate bombing and rocket fire into Palestinian land.
All right, Richard, let's get back here to the UK and discuss this story that's really kicked up a storm on social media and elsewhere. Tell us why those working for the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, are furious.
Well, they're furious, they're in uproar, because the government and Chancellor Rishi Sunak have proposed a 1%, and yes, I said 1% pay rise for frontline health workers. And this almost seems unconscionable by most honest assessments of the situation, not least because we're in the middle of a pandemic. The NHS has been shown to be more vital than ever, saving lives, essentially, you know, needed more than ever. And, you know, frontline health workers are the ones that have been saving people's lives, often at a cost to their own life. You know, we've lost thousands of NHS workers during this pandemic. And a lot of people are really making the point, too, that Boris Johnson himself, when he contracted COVID-19 last year, he himself acknowledged, you know, the NHS saved his life. Boris Johnson was in an ICU, an intensive care unit. And also it was NHS midwives that also delivered his baby successfully, his newborn baby with his wife, again, during the middle of this pandemic. And a lot of people are saying, look, is this the way that the NHS is being repaid for all the work they've been doing? And actually, as a result of this, Saeed, the NHS are now preparing to strike. And I suspect they'll have the support from many, many millions of people around the country.
All right, let's hear from some of the people who have been watching this story, Richard.
So let's go to Susie Wong, because Tory scum has been hashtagging on social media. Hashtag Tory scum, perpetuating social and financial division, now undermining a century of work and sacrifice to make your country a civilized place to live. And Mark Jessett also chimed in with this: selfishness, arrogance, greed, elitism, unfair advantage, dishonesty, callousness, willful cruelty, a short list of things that make Tory scum. And you know something, Saeed, I scoured online for a long time today and I struggled to find any supportive comments really about the Conservative government in the context of this announcement, which is going to affect, you know, scores and scores of vital NHS frontline health workers.
Pitiful, Richard, is one of the adjectives that people have been using to describe this infinitesimal rise in the NHS workers' pay. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And we're going to leave it there for now. Don't go anywhere.
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The characteristics of Tabriz and Azerbaijan. As for Tabriz, well, the 29th of Behman of 1356 was a glorious event in terms of its jihadi and operational significance. It was an important endeavor, and it is really a source of pride for the people of Tabriz. But the glories of Azerbaijan and Tabriz are not confined to this jihadi accomplishment and such other accomplishments. The scope of the city's and this area's glories is much wider. I will cite some examples. One is the cultivation of outstanding personalities. Azerbaijan, in particular Tabriz, is a producer of outstanding personalities in science, arts, and politics. During the past 150 years, I have not studied there as before that, in both religious and natural sciences, this area is an exemplary and truly elite generating area because of cultivating great faqis, scholars, orators, and scientists in natural sciences.
Your light and love, policy. Nothing more I'd ever wanna need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
So, Azerbaijan is known for cultivating outstanding personalities in scientific and artistic areas. As an example of Tabrizi poets and artists of all genres, they mention the late Shahriyar, God mercies be upon him. I also believe that this is true, but it is not only him. There were many poets in Tabriz who composed poems either in Farsi or in Turkish. Azerbaijan also offered many outstanding personalities in the area of politics. Therefore, cultivating outstanding personalities is one of the characteristics of this area, and that should be preserved. Another characteristic is challenging the historic and political developments of the country. In the past 150-200 years, Azerbaijan has been an influential factor in challenging developments. Sometimes, a person only joins a movement, and sometimes a person creates an orientation and causes a development, and they influence its formation and its continuation.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.